Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nobody saw it coming, said Condoleezza Rice last week, after Hamas militiamen stormed through the Gaza Strip, threw out U.S.-backed Fatah security, and ripped the map of the Palestinian world in half. In five stunning, bloody days, Fatah ran. The democratically elected government that Hamas dominated is now in tatters. Hamas runs Gaza. Fatah runs the West Bank. And Israel, the U.S., and Europe are lining up behind the West Bank. But Palestinian hopes and dreams are not so easily divided. Up next on Point, Palestinians speak on the earthquake that has torn their world. In a moment, we'll be joined by two prominent Palestinian voices from Jerusalem and Ramallah, Sari Nusseibeh and Hanan Ashrawi, and later in the hour by a member of the Palestinian diaspora watching events from the U.S. But first, for the latest developments, we turn to Tagreed Hodari in Gaza City. She reports there for the New York Times. Tagreed, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Hi. I just visited Erez checkpoint, which is the only exit for the Gazans to go to the West Bank. Hundreds of Fatah supporters are stuck there for now 4 days between Qassam members, the military wing of Hamas, and the Israelis on the other side. They are trying to escape Hamas and waiting for Israel's mercy to get through to the West Bank. Daily life, Tom, has not resumed yet due to the uncertainty and the loss that people feel. People are only buying basic needs and remain indoors, afraid of what's coming, afraid that Israel will cut off electricity, water, medical supplies, and food supplies. All people can predict is more fear from Hamas government that isn't able to clarify to them its political vision for the coming stage. Very few numbers of governmental employees today turned to work this morning. Others who aren't Fatah nor Hamas or those supporters of Fatah remain indoors. A group of employees went to their work at the Ministry of Finance at 8 a.m. but left at 10. They said, we are lost. We don't understand which government to abide by its order, the one in the West Bank or the one in Gaza. All these employees have families, all have loans, all suffered due to the American administration's economical embargo imposed on all governmental employees for almost a year and a half. A lot of them buying their food supplies on credit. Palestinians in Gaza are still in a state of shock. They are expecting the darkest days in their life to come. They keep talking about their loved children. Policemen are also confused. The government in the West Bank calling them not to work with Hamas, and Hamas asking them to resume work to achieve one of their many challenges, which is internal security. Not aware that Hamas military wing, the Qassam, is raiding Fatah houses at night. The moderates, the independents, and the silent majority are afraid to walk around. For the first time in their life, they feel that they are not belonging. There is a feel of not belonging, feeling of out of place. You know, they do blame Fatah, Hamas, Israel, and the U.S. administration for weakening them. Fatah for not focusing on reforming itself after Hamas won the elections. In contrary, after the death of Arafat, the division within Fatah has deepened. Hello, Tom. Yes. Do you think I have time to keep on? Because I have many things to talk.
We want to ask some simple questions, Tagreed, if I may. It was only about a week ago that you still had a unity government. There had been elections. Hamas had won a majority in the parliament. They were sharing power with Fatah, though Fatah had kept hold of the security apparatus. Can you describe for us the changes in that week? Hamas now runs Gaza. Mahmoud Abbas has disbanded the unity government. He's declared an emergency government. Formally, what has happened in this week?
What has happened is one thing, you know, and people can see it very clearly in Gaza. Qassam members are in control.
This is the Hamas militia.
Yeah, Hamas, you know, military wing is in control. Political leaders within Hamas political faction were behind, with the Qassam, were behind implementing such attack, implementing this coup d'etat against the government. These people, I think the world has failed, the American administration has failed to understand their mentality. The only people who are happy, free in the streets are the Qassam members. These people have been living miserable conditions. They have been wanted by both the American allies since 1996 and also by Israel.
And are these the young men with their faces covered that we see?
They think that they are revenging. They have revenged the U.S. and their allies. You know, I think they committed a political suicide. This is how I see it. And this is how many people, the moderates, the silent majority in Gaza, even the pragmatic within Hamas, they are silent. They cannot speak out. They are afraid now to even criticize Hamas for such a miserable political decision that they came out with.
Tagrid, Condoleezza Rice said nobody saw this coming. Is that true?
I think the U.S. administration has repeatedly weakened, you know, the moderates, the independents. They only, you know, they have been taken miserable miserable decisions. They, you know, through deliberate neglect and clumsy intervention, and through listening only to Israel and those Palestinians that are not popular on the ground and viewed by the Palestinians to be corrupt and abusing security forces to cause lawlessness.
But are you talking about Fatah there? You're talking about Fatah?
No, I'm talking about Condoleezza Rice and the American administration and how they have failed to understand the situation on the ground, to understand that this can be coming through such policies of embargo, through such policies of keeping Gaza in, you know, being, you know, stuck, keeping these Hamas guys stuck in one box and turn them into becoming, you know, after revenge and nothing more.
Tagrid, let me ask you, what about the conversation among Palestinians about their own responsibility for this breakdown? Is there a sense of failure within the Palestinian community?
Yes, they do. You know, they do feel that, and they are very miserable. They blame Fatah big time. They blame also Hamas. Nobody is happy with that, even Hamas supporters. You know, the last rally that Hamas came out with to celebrate the victory in the Gaza Strip, the so-called victory in the Gaza Strip, only Hamas supporters came out to that rally, not the silent majority who voted for them to revenge Fatah in the elections. And that was a very shocking sign for Hamas.
Hamas has spoken up for the establishment of an Islamic State. Is there evidence already, just in these few days, that that will be their goal? Is it already being enforced? Are women wearing more, headscarf and covering and so on?
Yeah, Tom, as a journalist, I'm not veiled. I'm a Palestinian too.
Yes.
And I'm moderate, I'm independent, and I'm lucky to be so. But the thing is, I've been witnessing myself, you know, a few incidents, you know, like you have an executive force, what Hamas is referring to them now as a policeman, is asking me that is telling me yesterday that I deserve to be killed for not wearing the veil. This is very shocking. This is the first time in my life to hear such a sentence from someone, like, you know, what used to be like a fighter, and then now, you know, the fighter is turning into a policeman. That's the shocking. And I think Hamas is realizing this now. They are stuck. The political wing within Hamas is stuck. They are dealing with Qassam members who have never been outside, who don't know their people, who don't understand politics. They've been stuck in, you know, hidden. And I don't know what's the outcome. And people are afraid of them.
The Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said on his way to Washington that the Fatah government without Hamas could mean a new opening. And we see reports today that Mahmoud Abbas, who now, you know, heads up a forum of the Palestinian government in the West Bank, says it may be time to go back to peace talks, to resume Middle East peace talks without Hamas.
Is there up?
I think their policies are always based on reaction. Nothing. They are not looking in the long term. What will happen? What will be the result? What? They want to seal off Gaza? So there are many moderate voices here. There are many independent. And I call your guest today to do something because they are considered one of the most moderate voices
yes.
in the Palestinian society. Do not let Gaza turn into a big jail. Do not let Gaza being misunderstood by the world, by the international community. And I call the American administration, do not repeat same mistakes. Listen, try to respect, and don't be blind and just be after whatever you think is right. Listen to moderate voices. Listen to everyone on the ground. Not to be listening to people you agree with.
Taghrid Khodari, do you have the sense that this Palestinian community can be put back together? Or is this split going to be with you for a long time?
I think it's gonna be miserable for a long time. I think, you know, nobody can predict what will be coming. Okay, I think the people in the West Bank today, you know, the situation there is not as complicated as in Gaza. And I think they're so happy for one thing, that the American economical embargo will be lifted. That's it.
In the West
but
Bank.
After. I mean, like the employees will get their salaries. They've been, you know, imagine yourself, Tom, not that your boss will tell you, Tom, you won't get your salary for 1 year or I don't know, maybe a few years. And from time to time, we're going to get you part of your salary. And you have to be happy. You have to live with it.
Taghrid Khodari in Gaza City. She reports there for the New York Times. Taghrid, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
We're going to go to Ramallah and Jerusalem in this hour. Joining me right now from Ramallah is Hanan Ashrawi. She's an independent member of the Palestinian Legislative Council or Parliament. She's a member of the Third Way Party, which she founded along with Salam Fayyad, who is now, in just the last few days, the new Prime Minister of the Palestinian government. She's author of This Side of Peace, a personal account. Hanan Ashrawi, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
It is hard to know where to begin, but just step back for a minute and try to share with us your experience and your perception of this last week in Gaza and the West Bank. How do you begin to respond to what's happened here?
Well, first of all, I mean, anybody who didn't see this coming obviously wasn't looking.
I.e. Condoleezza Rice.
Or was deliberately blind. No, Condoleezza Rice and everybody else who claims to be surprised. We've been cautioning against this. All the symptoms were in place. We had a situation of extreme polarization. We had a situation in which Hamas was gaining ascendancy because the voices of peace and moderation, so to speak, were not listened to or reciprocated to and were dealt a very serious blow by a failed peace process, by a failed American policy, by lack of any type of positive intervention. And because Israel was given a free hand and full immunity to act with impunity, to continue to lay siege to Palestine, both the West Bank and Gaza, to continue the systematic dismantlement of Palestinian economy and Palestinian realities, to continue creating this state of extreme deprivation and vulnerability and a sense of victimization. And the international community did not step in, provide any kind of hope that there would be a genuine peace process.
But Israel left Gaza Strip, Hanan Ashrawi, and everybody watched it. There was a lot of talk then about a new day dawning.
Well, absolutely. That's why, when you say Israel left, this is one reason why we believe the media contributed to misleading people, because Israel did not leave Gaza. Israel reorganized the occupation. We started by saying we want a devolution of occupation and evolution of statehood. We ended up with devolution of statehood and evolution of occupation.
But the Israeli settlers did leave. The Israeli settlers were pulled out.
I'll tell you how they stayed. The occupation did not manifest itself in Gaza only in the presence of settlements and settlers. Mm. The occupation is a system of control. And Israel exercised the system of control in a very insidious manner by saying, okay, they will withdraw the 14,000, 18,000 settlers. And at the same time, they kept control over all the crossing points, the territorial waters, the sea, the airspace. And they maintained that they had the full right. They surrounded Gaza with a wall, and they had the full right to exercise what they call security measures or military control from a distance. So they became an occupier without any responsibility, but with full overriding military power and they laid siege to Gaza in the most cruel and destructive manner. Gaza was closed in. It became a massive prison. It became a real powder keg. And we kept warning. I personally talked to Dr. Reichsbekannte. I talked to everybody saying, Gaza, I mean, you have to give them a sense of relief. You cannot allow this pressure cooker effect to continue to build. And you cannot continue to disregard and to defeat the voices of peace. Because the voices of moderation were not listened to. There was no viable peace process. Israel was continuing with its measures. I mean, look, since they said they left Gaza, they were continuing with their incursions, with shelling, with bombing, with abductions, with assassinations, and, as I said, with the territorial siege that turned Gaza not only into a prison, but into a real, a place where there is no hope. And with hopelessness, of course, comes extremism and violence.
Hanan Ashouri, there's also a Palestinian history here that I want to be sure all of our listeners understand, that after the creation of Israel in 1948, Gaza was under Egyptian oversight, the West Bank under Jordanian. Very different paths for these, and in part out of that, in the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt, came Hamas. And there was real conflict when Fatah came back, when Yasser Arafat and his crew came into the Palestinian community. There's a long-standing fight here.
Yeah, well, it's not that long-standing. Yes, there has always been a tension between the Islamic political movements and the national movements, and the nationalist or progressive movements in the Arab world. And, of course, the U.S. at that time, early on, you know, supported the Islamic movements and the religious movements, especially in the days of the Cold War, as a way of undermining Arab nationalism and, of course, fighting the spread of communism. So many of these, including, you know, the Taliban and others, many of these extreme or religious movements were the West's instrument to check the tide of nationalism and perceived communism in the days of the Cold War. But anyway, Hamas is a recent, is a latecomer to the Palestinian scene. Hamas was formed in early 1988 with the first Intifada as an offshoot, yes, of the Muslim Brotherhood, but it was a very, very modest component of Palestinian realities. The PLO, with Fatah as the major component of the PLO, was the major political force. And it stood for nationalism. It had the standing and the support of the Palestinian people because of its long history of struggle.
And for secular rule.
And as a national liberation movement, you see. And representing the identity of the Palestinians, the national identity, not the Islamic or religious or ideological identity.
And now we have Hamas pretty much entirely in control in Gaza. Hanan Ashouri in Ramallah, please stand by for just a moment if you'd be good enough. We now have joining us as well from Jerusalem, Sari Nusseibeh. He's president of Al-Quds University in Jerusalem, teaches philosophy there. He's author of Once Upon a Country, comes from one of Jerusalem's historic families. He's been a voice of moderation for a long time. Sari Nusseibeh, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. I said the same to Hanan Ashouri. It's hard to know where to begin. What is your response, broadly, to the events of the last week, 10 days?
Well, it's a very frustrating, it's a very depressing situation at the moment. I think we're probably going through an extremely difficult phase, perhaps one that will be epoch or history-making, in the sense that radical changes are taking place in our society, in our community. And I believe very quickly the political map is being transformed regarding what's possible, what's not possible, what's going to happen to the future of Israeli-Palestinian relations. Indeed, what's going to happen within the Palestinian community to the Palestinian political map. So far, of course, we've had one map that was clear to us to some extent. And we heard this being discussed a while ago by my colleague Hanan, but...
Hello, sorry. Hanan Ashouri, we see reports today that Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has been on the phone with President Bush, saying that this is the time to resume stalled Middle East peace talks. What do you think of that?
Well, that's nothing new. Mahmoud Abbas has been calling for peace talks since day one. He adopted the sort of very moderate agenda. He adopted the nonviolent approach. He wholeheartedly embraced the call for peace. And for reform and change and nonviolence and so on. Unfortunately, years ago even, he wasn't listened to. Nobody reciprocated in ways that would strengthen Mahmoud Abbas's agenda. Now I'm afraid saying these things might be misconstrued by people as consolidating this rift between Gaza and the West Bank, as creating two systems, the statelet or mini-state of Gaza, totally closed in, hemmed in, being punished collectively by the international community, being punished by having a system like the Hamas military wing controlling it, and at the same time you have the West Bank being treated quite differently, which means that there is a real severance between, a real rift between Gaza and the West Bank, which would deal a lethal blow to Palestinian national aspirations and to any potential statehood as a means of conflict resolution.
Sorry, Nusaybi.
What Teddy was talking about is very important, though. These are cataclysmic changes, yes. This is one of the worst periods in our history, I'm sure, since 1948, 1967, and we can say 2007, because the internal rift in itself is a source not just of weakening the Palestinian national cause and making it even more vulnerable to external negative intervention, but it is also a battle over the soul of Palestine. What kind of society, what kind of political system, what kind of values do we have in Palestine? Are we going to become a closed, ideological, Islamic, absolutist society with ruled by militias or not even a police state? Or are we going to grow into what we were building as a democratic, pluralistic, tolerant, contemporary, enlightened state?
Sorry, Nusaybi, how do you see that? If there's now an open struggle for the soul of Palestine, as Hanan Ashrawi puts it, with Gaza in the hands of Hamas, Fatah in the West Bank, where does that struggle go?
Well, I don't think that Gaza and the West Bank are divided like that, and I think it's wrong to just accept the division territorially by saying Gaza is run by Hamas and the West Bank by Fatah. I believe the two parts of the Palestinian occupied areas, that's to say Gaza and the West Bank, continue to be one entity, socially, politically, economically, in many different ways.
But de facto, as we speak
as
today,
are people sorry?
De facto, as we speak today, are they not divided?
De facto, what you have is a group of people in control here who are Fatah, basically at the helms.
Please go ahead.
No, but if you look at the society as a whole, I'm saying, I mean, you know, Gaza is made up of the same population that the West Bank is made up of, and it's the same families, the same classes, the same political leanings and so on. But it is being run by a group of Hamas in Gaza. It's being run by a group of people from Fatah in the West Bank. But I don't think they should blind us to the fact that we're one entity, one people.
I want to begin to hear from our listeners, if we may. Let me take a call from Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I am a great admirer of Mrs. Ashrawi, and her analysis of the situation is right on the mark. The one thing that she did not touch on, though, is the one thing that's key to this whole situation. Hamas would never have been able to rise to the heights that it had risen to if it hadn't been for the corruption going throughout Fatah, starting from the top down, from Yasser Arafat. The corruption was just rampant. Apart from that, in addition to that, you had failure of United States policy. You had the problems with Israel, its lack of vision where it comes to Palestine.
But you say, don't forget about the corruption. Let us pick it up. Hanan Ashrawi, what do you say to that?
No, I think so, yes. I think the clear case of mismanagement, corruption, even arrogance, abuse of power by Fatah and by the PLO as a whole, represented by Fatah, has led to extreme alienation by the public. There was a very negative reaction. The elections that Hamas won did not win on its own merits or because the Palestinians suddenly became ideological and decided to adopt the Hamas agenda. Mm. Many of them elected Hamas in reaction to the Fatah corruption deal and perceived, and in revenge. So we say Hamas won the ideological vote, yes, but it won basically the revenge vote, the angry vote, the protest vote, the despair vote, because all those people who were reacting to the existing political system and its abuses and its failures.
And we saw that made manifest last week as government offices and mansions stripped right down to the walls. Let me take a call from Kingston, Ontario. Arielle, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Tom. I don't think it's much to add beyond what Hanan Ashrawi has to say, because I'm also a great fan of hers. And as an American Jew who left the United States in part because of Bush's administration policy to the Middle East, I have to say that we do have to look at the way they've treated the Palestinians and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in an analogous way as what they've done in Iraq, which is peace process. If what they've conceived as a peace process in the Middle East, or how their input in the Palestine and Israel is the same as their notion of liberation of Iraq. So I think we do have to put a great onus there. At the same time, the whole concept of this peace process from inception, the Oslo Accords, has done nothing but create the basis for this, because with every minimal step forward in some kind of political recognition has been 10 steps backward in terms of losing territory by the Palestinians to Israel, further illegal annexations, and in many ways culminating in the final rounds of the Clinton negotiation, wherein Arafat was asked to basically let go of Jerusalem, creating such a situation of hostility and mistrust that only opened the doors for someone like Ariel Sharon to walk in and basically.
So we hear what a big critic you are of that whole process.
Downward spiral.
Yeah, Ariel, let me take it to Hanan Ashrawi. What about peace process, where it's been and where it could go now? Can it go anywhere in this current situation, Hanan?
Well, there has been no peace process since the year 2000. Remember when Barak, after the Taba talks, after Camp David and then the Taba talks and then Sharon's incursion into the Haram al-Sharif and the eruption of the Intifada, there have been no talks whatsoever, only military violence and escalation of repression and brutality. So that has undermined, actually, the voices of peace, as I said, and any momentum towards negotiations. Israel has adopted the stance that there is no Palestinian partner. So unilateralism and the negation of partnership became the name of the game since the year 2000.
We've been joined this hour from Ramallah in the West Bank by Hanan Ashrawi. Sari Nusseibeh was with us from Jerusalem. It looks like we may have lost him. We're joined as well right now from Berkeley, California, by a member of the Palestinian diaspora, Bishara Dumani. He's a professor of social history at UC Berkeley. He writes about the everyday life in Palestinian society. Bishara Dumani, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
You're on the air with Hanan Ashrawi, who joins us from Ramallah. What have you made
Hi,
of this?
Hanan.
Hi, Bishara. Good to hear your voice again.
Same.
Bishara, what have you made of this, watching on from California, half a world away?
It's a very, very painful experience. I can't help but be very worried about my relatives and my friends as they go through what is clearly going to be a very long and dark period in their history. What's happened in the last week culminates a number of developments that have been going on for a long time, and it makes it clear that there won't be any light at the end of the tunnel for some time to come. And one of the things that make me very worried is that this policy that Israel has followed of fragmenting the West Bank is a legal fiction, by the way. There are many different sort of open-air prisons which Israel controls the exits and entry to, and they have been isolated from each other for a very long time. So they will all go through their own sort of internal development in which there's no real clear connecting national Palestinian presence that is in control of all of them. And Nablus, you've just mentioned, is one of those places that might see possibly an increase of fighting within Nablus itself.
Let me ask Hanan Ashrawi about that. Hanan, do you have a fear that the kind of fighting we saw in Gaza last week will now come into the West Bank? Hamas has a significant presence there as well.
Certainly, yes. There have been great fears and expressed very openly. What we're trying to do here is to prevent the spillover effect, to prevent what happened in Gaza from taking place in the West Bank, because resorting to violence and coming out with open factional clashes and confrontations would only lead to greater hardship and would be disastrous to the Palestinians as a whole. So one of the first responsibilities of the emergency government is to try to maintain law and order, rule of law, try to control whatever armed group there are, despite the fact that, as Shara said, we are living in a highly fragmented place where we have over 540 Israeli military checkpoints, where every town, city, and village is cut off from the other. And so we're trying very hard to try to maintain some sort of law and order, some sort of calm, and to prevent further deterioration on the ground in order to attempt to restore unity to between the West Bank and Gaza, which is something that is extremely difficult given the conditions now.
Bashara Dumani, what about the credibility of this new Palestinian government? I mean, there were elections. Hamas won. Now that government has been swept aside by emergency measures by Mahmoud Abbas. You know, he's put Hanan Ashrawi's ally, Salam Fayyad, in as prime minister, but the vote went the other way. Does that matter anymore?
I think both Fatah and Hamas have discredited themselves in the eyes of most Palestinians, and I don't think that either of them are in place in a way that would make a long-term solution possible. This is clearly a transitional and fluid period. No Palestinian, when they're talking about what's going on, can help but point out the larger context, the great power imbalance in which the Palestinians are clearly the weaker party. What others do, especially the United States and Israel, is of great importance. Nevertheless, Palestinians must, you know, they do have some room for maneuver and they must bear responsibility for their own actions. And what we have here is a situation in which we may see the beginning of a great sort of reconfiguration of how they organize or themselves politically in ways that are representative not only of the various forces in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and West Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, but also of the Palestinians in the diaspora, of the refugees in Lebanon and Syria and Jordan and elsewhere, as well as their sisters and brothers who are Palestinian citizens.
But what kind of reorientation can you imagine?
Well,
I mean, the facts are on the ground there, aren't they?
Well, at this point, there's a need, I think, to rebuild the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, as a larger umbrella organization. There is a need for Palestinians to clarify what is it that they want, what the end game is, because there are different competing visions which must be discussed democratically. And I think there also is a need to identify more clearly what the modes of resistance to occupation and what are the modes of trying to achieve freedom, self-determination are. And I think there are strong and important voices for a nonviolent struggle that needs to be carried out systematically and over the long term.
Hanan Ashrawi there in Ramallah, do you still have hope for a nonviolent path here? Last week we saw men with guns, and now men with guns in both Gaza and the West Bank. Once that's underway, I mean, the Intifada was stones, now it's rifles. It seems harder to get back to nonviolence once so many rifles are around.
Yes, it's been extremely difficult to try to re-legitimize nonviolence, precisely because every time we tried to carry out a sort of massive nonviolent movement, Israel would respond with maximum violence. But anyway, that's one thing. Two, there are now weapons and arms. They've been used against each other, basically. Something that has been seen as a very drastic departure from previous internal or domestic dynamic in Palestine. And three, the fact is the Palestinian exiles or the Palestinians outside Palestine, this is another issue that we need to talk about because they have been in many ways sidelined and excluded. And that has led to a very difficult situation where we were dealt with only with part of the Palestinian population on part of the Palestinian territory. And that certainly did not produce anything beyond greater grief. But within Palestine now, the dynamic has shifted, yes, and I think the failure of both the nationalist schools, the nationalist parties or blocs or factions or whatever, the failure even of the left to come up with any alternative and to reinvent itself as a contemporary rather than a factional ideological movement, and that has left Hamas as being the only option. Unfortunately, Hamas resorted to violence. They did win elections, yes. They were free and fair elections, but in a highly abnormal situation that tainted the results of the election. And so Hamas, in a sense, when it carried out this violent attack in Gaza to take over the security forces, it was like carrying out a coup d'etat against itself, so to speak, because it couldn't control peacefully all the institutions it wanted to control because Fatah was holding on. So it resorted to violence, and therefore now we see a totally different dynamic. I do not think you will see a revival of the nationalist movement unless Fatah itself decides to be not just reinvent itself, but reform itself drastically, to democratize, to institutionalize, and to learn from its mistakes, which is not really evident. And Hamas, frankly, is very keen on maintaining power. I think you will see Hamas trying to show Israel that it can deliver security, trying to release the people who were abducted, including Alan Johnston and even Shalit, trying to show that it can
BBC
control
reporter.
The situation, whereby not a single Qassam rocket will be fired on Israel, because what it seeks is legitimacy and recognition and longevity in power. And as I said earlier, this is a battle over the nature of Palestinian society and political system, not just brute force and brute power, and not even in relation to Israel at certain points, but in relation to the control over Palestinian society and the Palestinian system as a whole.
Hanan Ashrawi, Bashar Dumani, let me get a couple of calls to consider on the table here. From Granby, Connecticut, I should say we're at 800-423-8255. In Granby, Connecticut, Susan, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is, why do you think the neighboring country of Egypt to Gaza and Jordan in the West Bank are not coming to the aid of the Palestinians? Why is there this
coming to the aid in what way, Susan? In what manner?
You hear of the humanitarian struggle there, lack of services and power and aid, and yet the borders on Egypt and Jordan are basically closed to the Palestinians. And why do you think that is?
Bashar Dumani, she says, what about the Arab world? Why haven't they done more to step in and help Palestinians in Gaza and West Bank?
Well, they consider, first of all, the Arab world is a misnomer. There are Arab governments and Arab peoples, and the governments have not been that sympathetic to the cause of the Palestinians. They see the Palestinian situation as a great destabilizing force. Jordan does not want to open its borders. Neither does Egypt, because they're afraid of a big influx of people, which will then upset their own rule. They do have interests in trying to control what goes on there in indirect ways. Egypt has been, in many ways, through its internal security forces, running a kind of a brokerage in the West Bank between the different factions, running the security situation for the past 5 years or so. Jordan was in control of the West Bank for a very long time, but had to give way to the Palestinian themselves to run their own affairs. And I know that there is a kind of a systematic asphyxiation of Palestinian society going on through Israeli and U.S. Combined measures of siege. And that is causing great many people to want to leave, to find a better life for themselves and for their children if they could. And they don't want a great demographic sort of spillover from the West Bank into Jordan.
Yeah. Could I add something?
Yes, please.
Here, Tom. The thing is, neither Egypt nor Jordan controls the borders with the Palestinians. It's Israel as an occupying power that is controlling all the crossing points, and as I said, the airspace, the territorial waters, and so on. So the Palestinians are under siege and under tight military control by the Israeli occupation. And anybody who wants to come to the Palestinians in any way or intervene has to go through Israel, has to go through coordination with the Israelis or to get military permission and so on. So we are still under Israeli, we are still under occupation, which in a sense adds insult to injury, the fact that here are the Palestinians, fighting internally.
But Hanan Ashrawi, let me ask you, somehow a lot of weapons have certainly come into Gaza.
Absolutely,
The hand of Iran, we've certainly seen it in Lebanon. Are we seeing Iran now as the key player in this, what looks like a breakup?
which brings you to a serious question. How did these weapons come in? Of course, everybody complains about tunnels and smuggling and so on. And how come, if the borders were so tightly sealed, as nobody could come in and go out, and how come now we see this massive amassing of weapons, a stockpile of weapons and sophisticated weapons? When the Palestinian people were starving in Gaza, how come hundreds of millions of dollars were spent on weapons or you know, weapons were spent?
What's the answer?
I have no idea. I think that this needs further investigation. Unfortunately, I'm not able to do that. But people are wondering, where did they come from? How did they come? If it's only through tunnels, smuggled through tunnels, do you think tunnels are that hard to locate and stop? But very clearly, there are some vested interests in seeing Palestinians, you know, fight other Palestinians. However, could I go back to something crucial
yes.
that we did not talk about?
Yes.
The fact that when Hamas won elections, Israel and the U.S., followed by the Europeans, decided to boycott, decided to impose sanctions on the Palestinians. This dealt a double blow, one to the idea of democracy, that you can have elections provided you can guarantee the outcome, or you elect the people we like. And if you elect the people we don't like, we will punish you. So that dealt a serious blow to democracy. And two, it dealt a serious blow to American standing in the region, and of course to the voices of moderation and peace in the region. Because it was seen that Hamas was the victim. It was positioned as being the victim. Therefore, if it failed, it would have a perfect excuse for its failure. And at the same time, it made people rally to defend Hamas. So instead of having a normal, healthy democracy where Hamas would be in power and the Palestinians, I have no love lost for Hamas and I would be in the opposition. But we have the right to be the opposition. Israel and the U.S. cannot usurp our role as opposition and decide to punish all the Palestinians simultaneously.
But Hamas is dedicated to the destruction of Israel, we're told. How could Israel break bread with Hamas?
Let me jump in on that, because Hamas is not a cohesive movement. Also, it has many different currents in it. And I think, and many other people think, that if they were allowed to sort of exercise their democratic rights and be part of a political process as, and not just shut out, then we may have a very different situation than the one we're in now.
Hanan Ashrawi, we've just got a minute
yeah.
left. Do you think
yeah.
Hamas can really become part of some kind of process that leads to peace? What about the idea floated in Washington in the last few days and in Israel? Well, now we'll deal with the West Bank and we'll shunt Gaza and Hamas aside.
I think this is absolutely short-sighted and irresponsible. You cannot fragment the Palestinians further. You cannot create a situation of tremendous volatility and pain and then say we will deal with the outcome. If there is a real movement towards peace, then they have to understand that the Palestinians as a whole are one nation, that you have to deal with territoriality as one Palestinian state, and you cannot sort of divide and conquer, because right now the result, the consequences of these short-sighted policies and of allowing standing back and allowing Israel to escalate and allowing violence to go on the rise and so on, have led to this disastrous situation. We need now to undo the damage, and we need a comprehensive, active peace process. And there is an Arab initiative that can be picked up, and they can run with it if they want.
A Palestinian crisis and voices today of Palestinians with us. Hanan Ashrawi, a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council, joining us from Ramallah. Thank you very much. Be safe. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Bashara Dumani at UC Berkeley, part of the Palestinian diaspora. Professor Dumani, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.